Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Drexel.
And today on the pod, we are going to talk about the travel ban, which is in front of the Supreme Court this past week. We are also going to talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner and Trump, a.k.a. the Pajama Bandit.
The Pajama Bandit?
What I just have this... mean? No, I don't know. I just have this idea in my head that he called into Fox and Friends while, like, wearing his, like, striped pajamas and, like... was just, I don't know, I thought it was funny.
The look on their faces
so
was
good.
Priceless.
It was so good.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, so good show today. I'm very excited about it. Drexel, how was your weekend?
It was good. I got sick over the weekend, so if I sound a little funny, it's because I am getting over a cold, which
you're
I'm
welcome.
Glad it's now and not later. Yeah, it's that Jersey cold.
That Jersey cold I brought
you. Not the New York cold.
The Jersey cold.
The Jersey cold.
Yeah.
And I actually watched a good bit of the Marvel movies this weekend.
Oh, you did?
I did. I sat on my couch yesterday and watched like Iron Man 3 and Guardians of the Galaxy, which I had never seen Guardians of the Galaxy before.
It's a good one.
What's that?
It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one. And then I watched Guardians of the Galaxy 2 because it's on Netflix. So that I could prepare me for
Infinity War. Yeah. I still have to see Civil War and then I can see Infinity War.
How about you? How was your weekend?
It was good. It was, everyone in my family is getting over some sort of sickness. So it was a lot of us laying on the couch and watching kids movies.
Nice.
So always fun.
That's fun.
All right, Drexel, let's jump into some listener feedback. We got a lot of feedback about our show on Monday, about our discussion on Democratic messaging.
Great.
Yes. There was.
And I never seen this feedback, by the way, guys. So I'm always surprised when I come into the studio and I'm like, ooh, what did people say about last week?
Yeah. There was just, it was a lot of, I think one of the criticisms that we got was, are we internalizing criticism from the right and making it a problem for us?
I don't think so.
Okay. So, because when you said messaging, like that we don't have a message, because that did seem to be a main refrain from the right.
But I don't think that it's necessarily a refrain from the right so much as it is we don't like to hear things that we already know.
Right.
And we know that the criticism, even from our own party, people who... the part of the faction that we, you know, have been trying to bring into the fold. That's a criticism from the left. You know, I was just listening to MSNBC this morning where they were at the Progressive Campaign Committee caucus, whatever, something, you know, conference this weekend. And they talked about messaging and how they felt that a lot of progressives that are running, there's about 450 across the country, feel like, you know, there's not a central message. But of course their message is always Medicare for all,
right?
Like the same things. And the right's criticism of us is not on messaging. It is that they believe we have the wrong message.
Got it.
So, you know, I certainly don't give the time of day of what the right thinks about what we as a party do,
right?
But that said, I think that if we don't start to look at, you know, the Democratic Party didn't do an autopsy of the 2016 election. So there's no way, like, they could either blame it on Hillary Clinton, which is what a lot of people want to do, you know, oh, it didn't go into Michigan, you know, it didn't go into these certain places, Wisconsin, whatever. Or they can say, hey, we just didn't have the messaging. And there's a reason why we lost we lost legislatively across the country. There's a reason why we lost so many congressional seats. There's a reason why we don't have the governor's houses. And it's not because of anything. It's not because we didn't have the right candidates, because we didn't have the right messages. And if you look at 2012, Barack Obama won.
On a message. Right.
He had the message. He got it. His people got it.
Right.
But across the country, the party didn't have the message, and it wasn't permeating through some of those races that like it needed to. So, yeah, I mean, I understand how people can feel some type of way about hearing criticisms about our own party. But if we're not criticizing our own, then we're going to be in trouble.
And can we focus on all of it at once? So part of messaging is deciding what we talk about as a party, especially in these big elections like the midterm elections. And can we talk about Russia and infrastructure and judicial appointments? And can we talk about it all, or do we need to narrow it?
You can talk about it all. However, you have to know your audience. If you are in California, where we have Dana Rohrabacher and a few other Russia players, Devin Nunes and Daryl Issa, and a few people who have been at the forefront of making it very difficult for Hillary Clinton, making it very easy for Russia, and making it very easy for the Trump administration.
Talk about Russia.
Then you can make a case to your constituents if you're running against them. These are the key players that have aided and abetted X, Y, and Z. If you're in a state like Iowa or New Hampshire or Arizona or some of these places where we have a chance to flip, or Texas, they don't care about this stuff.
Right.
That's not what's on the forefront of their mind. And so
you think so?
I personally, it's not at the forefront of my mind. But if it's not at the forefront of my mind, I, as a politico, I don't know that it's going to be at the forefront of somebody else's mind who is thinking about their job and their family and their health care and things like that. We are oversaturated in the news by what's happening in Russia. So yeah, of course we're going to want to know more about it, because we are, we like that kind of stuff. But I think for the average voter, they're not really thinking about that so much. So yeah, so I think, but you can touch on it.
Right.
But it goes back to what I said last week, which was, if you're going to talk about it, people want to hear solutions about it.
Like, be smarter about how you frame it.
If you're going to say, hey, here's what's happening in Russia. Russia attacked our grid. Russia got into this. Here's what my plan is to combat that aggression. Here's what I need to do to say, we're going to lock down democracy in the way. We're going to help protect voting rights. We're going to help protect voters in general. We're going to make sure that cybersecurity is beefed up, because we need to do that. We're going to make sure that states have what they need to combat that, and parties have what they need, no matter what side of the aisle they're on. If the GOP needs help securing their servers, then we're gonna make sure that we have the funding in place to do that. If the Democratic Party needs to do that, then that's what we're gonna do. And that's what people need to be talking about.
So it's less about what we're talking about and more how we talk about it as a party. So messaging isn't necessarily removing things from the conversation. It's just reframing the conversation.
It's reframing it. And again, government, when people say government works for the people, if you are working a job, you don't go to your boss with problems. You go to your boss with solutions.
Right.
So if you're going to be a candidate, the boss is the people.
Right.
You're going to go with them with solutions, because they got 99 problems, and you certainly cannot be the one of them.
Right.
You need to be their solution.
Right.
So,
I like that. I like that kind of reframing of it. I also have another question, something that Sarah actually brought up in the Facebook group, which, if you're not in the Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, it is excellent. She asked a very interesting question, and it's related to messaging somewhat, but she was talking about if and when the Democratic Party gets a majority in all three branches of government, or hell, even two, should our goal to be create legislation and basically make sure that democratic norms are codified into law, so we don't run into some of these problems that the Republican Party has been spewing on us for the last 18 months? Or do we take a page out of the Republican playbook, take advantage of those loopholes, and push our own legislative agenda and our own judicial nominees, and basically tell the Republican Party to fuck off just like they told us to fuck off?
Well, in the words of Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high.
I mean, that's my response. Like, I believe, and Sarah brought up an interesting point when we were talking about this. She's like, well, bullies respond to strength. But I think that there is a certain strength in resisting that temptation and creating a safer, more fair democracy for us all.
Right. I think that one thing that we respected about Barack Obama was that he never went low with the Republican Party, and it, to his disadvantage sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why he had such a scandal-free, kind of almost drama-free presidency,
right,
even with the Republicans, is because he just did not engage with them in that way. Now, Harry Reid did,
yes.
Nancy Pelosi did, and that's their job, is to kind of work.
Right. Well, and that's also, but that's also kind of my point. Harry Reid took the nuclear option for a good reason. I mean, you want to talk about obstructionist. They were getting nothing done. But it worked short term, but blew up in our faces long term, because now we're dealing with the long term ramifications of that.
I think that we have to, I think for our own party, for our own constituents, we have to continue to be tough. But I think that's going to come with the right legislation. It's going to come with actually putting forth legislation on infrastructure, on healthcare, on education, and pushing those things through.
Right. I still think we should be creating legislation to make these democratic norms laws. I think it's important.
I think we definitely have, like I said, I think we definitely have to protect the
process.
And something I said, I don't know if I said it last week or if I said it in the group, which was we have to be able to use offices across the country to do that.
Right.
If Congress is the only one that's looking into something like that, then we're going to be in trouble. Like, I know that, like, I'd love to get Secretary Grimes, Secretary of State of Kentucky, on just to talk about how secretaries of states across the country are preparing for upcoming elections. And if the Democratic Party is working with them to come up with solutions to help combat those things. If you look at what Robert Mueller does, for example, and, you know, this came up last week where we talked about how he is kind of like embedding himself in and some of the attorneys and the prosecutors and attorneys across the country, especially in New York and D.C., if the Democratic Party can kind of embed goals into some of these major states, then that's the way to do it. Work with the mayors, work with the governors, work with the secretaries of states, work with the attorney generals to say, if Congress isn't going to do it, then you need to do it.
Right.
And you need to push those things, because then it's going to push other states to do it, because then constituents from red states are going to look at it and go, like, why aren't we being protected like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really interesting conversation. And I know that I actually have a pretty unpopular opinion on this, but I don't think absolute power in either the Republicans or the Democrats is a good idea.
Oh, I don't believe that either.
I think politicians are politicians, and I agree with some and I don't agree with others, but I don't think anyone should have unchecked power like that. And we need to do the work to prevent Democratic backsliding. And if we don't, we're no fucking better than them. And I don't want that. I truly, truly believe, you know, as tempting as it is to take advantage of these loopholes, and I'm not saying we don't fuck with them a little bit because I'm a petty ass person, but I am saying we need to make a good faith attempt to protect our democratic norms. Even if the Republicans won't do it, that's why we're Democrats.
Right. We just have to fight smarter.
Smarter, exactly. And so, yeah, well, I would love to hear more about what people think about this. I thought it was a great discussion on Facebook. So if you have any more thoughts on this, like, email, Facebook, Twitter, this is a super fun discussion.
And that just goes for any kind of discussion.
Any, like, kind of discussion.
If you have things that we say, like, put them in the group, because we read that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we will always text each other and be like, oh, yeah, that was good.
That was good.
We got to talk about that. All right, Devin, let's talk about SCOTUS,
yes,
or the Supreme Court of the United States. Every time I think of SCOTUS, I think of scrotum.
Me too.
It sounds like...
Wait, me too. I thought it was just me, Drexel.
Because when you say, like, yeah, it's really...
It looks like scrotum
it
every
does.
Time.
It does.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm not the only one. I was really worried about that. Shit.
So let's talk about SCOTUS. And what's been happening recently with the travel ban.
Yeah, so I believe it was last Wednesday, SCOTUS heard arguments in regards to the legality of the travel ban, which was introduced about 15 months ago, the original version had banned travel and entry from 7 majority Muslim countries. And it's since gone through a couple of iterations that have modified the countries and the people who are banned from travel. So the basic argument here is the government's position, which is being argued by Solicitor General Francisco. He's saying that this is not a Muslim ban. It's an attempt to curb terrorists from entering the country. He also is saying that, because the heart of this question is the intent behind it. And the defendants are basically saying this ban must be looked at in a larger context, specifically in the context of the anti-Muslim rhetoric used by Trump on the campaign trail. So the government is saying, no, you can't take a candidate's statements and apply that to policy positions once they take office. He literally said, once you take the oath of office, you are inherently changed as a person, and what you said as a candidate no longer applies. That's kind of the core of that piece of his argument. He also said that if this was in fact a Muslim ban in its current iteration, it would be very ineffective because it currently limits travel from Libya, Iran, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, North Korea, and Venezuela, which are not all Muslim majority countries. The defense is basically saying, so Neil Katyal, arguing for the defense, basically said, look, if this isn't a Muslim ban and if Trump has changed his stance on this, quote, the president could have disclaimed, easily moved away from all of these statements. Instead, he's embraced them, like recently, since being president.
Doubled down on them.
Right.
And if you look at some of the decisions from a lot of the federal judges, a lot of the circuit judges, they've used a lot of what the president said, not just on the campaign trail, but since he took office. In tweets, they've used that against him. So the argument that what he said on the campaign trail is irrelevant, considering that he, as soon as he became president, he continued to say those things. So I'm really surprised that the government is making that campaign argument.
Assertion.
You're like, but you said it after the oath of office.
If it was only on the campaign trail, that argument would hold more weight for me.
Right. And I think that I've not seen a decision yet from an appeals court or anything that has indicated that they've used campaign rhetoric as opposed to current president.
While he's president. Right. So here's the rub. What the court is really looking at, and this is all, you know, this is all people reading the tea leaves, as they say, of the Supreme Court, which is very difficult to do. But what it's kind of looking like is Ginsburg and Sotomayor are against the travel ban. Alito, Gorsuch and asshole, Thomas and Roberts are likely to want to uphold this ban. And then Kennedy, Breyer and Kagan are looking for a middle ground.
Right, because the Supreme Court typically does not like to get into national security issues with the president.
Right.
And so Kagan, who used to be Solicitor General, is of course going to look at it from the government standpoint. Kennedy, of course, is always the swing. And Justice Breyer is usually on the left, but I'm sure he's going to want to look for some middle ground as well. Roberts might be a surprise as he has in the past, but you know, Gorsuch was put there for a reason. Alito is like he's like a Death Eater.
he's the living embodiment of a
Death Eater. And of course, Thomas probably didn't ask a question.
He didn't.
But Thomas has also surprised
us
in the past as well.
That's
so I think again the argument from some of these judges is going to be how. Because what will end up happening is, I think, is that whatever, if the ruling is against the government, it will limit the power of the presidency,
right?
In certain aspects. So I don't think that they want to wade into that so much when it comes to national security, because that is in Article 1, like the purview of the commander in chief. Like what that's such a broad term, commander in chief.
Right.
It's almost like the war powers and declarations of war and like what Congress can do. Like, is the president able to do drone strikes without the authority of Congress.
Well, and I think that from what I'm understanding, and I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on this podcast, but from what I've read and from what I've heard and talked to people about, is that the core issue here and the middle ground that some of these justices are looking for, the office of the president is allowed to implement this kind of policy, particularly on the grounds of national security, which they want to stay the fuck out of. But this instance, this one instance, this one person, does it fall outside of that collective power? So I think that's a problem with this Trump presidency in a lot of ways, because the office of the presidency, especially with democratic norms that are not codified into law, he's just been like fucking around, like beating them all down.
Oh my gosh. Please keep that in.
I just threw my pen across the room.
Just arms flailing all over the place.
He just beat all of these democratic norms down. So the question is does the court want to limit the office of the presidency, or do they want to limit this one fuckhead?
The courts can't limit
this one fuckhead.
This one. They would have to limit the office of the
president. Right, which is, I think, the problem that they're having, especially like Kagan, who actually made a really interesting, she created an interesting hypothetical. Could an avowedly anti-Semitic president issue an order banning travel from Israel if his advisors had said that this was a national security issue, but he's very outspokenly anti-Semitic? How does that work?
And I think that John Roberts and Justice Alito, it seemed that they were worried that a ruling for the challengers might entangle courts in second-guessing the president's national security determinations, which could be a slippery slope for future presidents, because any time that somebody feels like they do not agree with the president's decisions on national security, they can always take it to the courts, which
right.
is something that the Supreme Court
does not want
to do, because that is not their job.
Well, they also don't have all the information. They're not privy to classified information that the intelligence community is. I understand that argument. But what I think there's a way to narrow the scope of this so that it deals with instances where there is a clear malintent. Like these comments that Trump, yes, made on the campaign trail, but also after he took the oath of office. Is there a way to not interfere with the general national security clause while still implementing boundaries for people who are obviously malintent?
Yeah, I think that the challengers, not the government, are going to have to make the argument that it would have an adverse effect on families across the country. That's because the Supreme Court really is going to, you know, especially people like Alito and Thomas, they're gonna look at how it affects Americans on its face. I think that that's gonna have to be part of the argument, which is how is that gonna affect the overall is it gonna affect families?
Right.
Is it a 14th Amendment issue? What is that? Because due process does not cover like foreigners,
right?
So they're gonna be like, well, okay.
There is no due process
there's
here,
no, right? There's no reason why they have to come over here unless they have family here.
Well, and I think it is worth taking a minute to remember that this case deals with real people, and also one piece that we haven't talked about here and hasn't really been talked about in the context of the SCOTUS arguments. This also dealt with the stemming of refugees coming into this country. It also goes a little bit into waivers and case-by-case basis and how that process could potentially work. Obviously, to me, it's clear that this is an anti-religion, racist policy that the Trump administration put in place because it was a campaign promise and then took some time revising it to make it look less racist. Right. They had a nexus. They had a central idea that they wanted. And after the courts basically told them, like, we see you, we fucking see you, they were like, oh, OK, well, we'll add some other things. And like, so it's not racist. It's, you know, whatever. And I think at this point, it's worth noting that no matter how SCOTUS rules, this is really opening a sickening window into how this administration in particular, but then how this country that elected this administration, whether we like it or not, treats Muslims and people of color. And regardless of the outcome of this, it was a racist, disgusting policy. I mean, we really need to reckon with that, I think.
Yeah, I know it's going to be very hard for Democrats to have that conversation about that, because national security is something that I think a majority of Americans, whether or not you're a Democrat or Republican, you want to feel safe.
Right.
And so it's going to be hard to have that continue to have that conversation, especially I don't think that we're going to be able to use that in the midterms, other than saying, you know, this is a clear violation of the First Amendment and Republicans don't care about the First Amendment. And I think that's going to have to be it's hard to prove intent.
Well, that's kind of the central issue here.
Right. Yeah. And so I unless the president blatantly goes out there and says, we want to keep all Muslims out.
Which, after his little jaunt on Fox and Friends, he might actually fucking do.
I mean, over in Michigan this weekend, he said, where are all the Mexicans at? They're not here? Oh, good. What did he say? Oh, good. Something nuts. And I was like, he said that out loud? So, yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting case. Either way, let's hope that Ginsburg let's hope that Kennedy doesn't retire this summer like they're speculating.
Oh, God. Sutton Basket has been rated the number one meal kit by leading publications, and it's no wonder why. They offer 18 weekly recipes with options for paleo, gluten-free, Mediterranean, lean and clean, vegan, and more. I love that it's so easy and delicious, and it really gets me to eat healthier. Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience you have in the kitchen. And I have zero. Alex does most of the cooking, all of the cooking. But I made a steak with roasted carrots all by myself on Friday night when Alex went out with some friends, and it wasn't even hard. And now you get more options than ever. Just go to the Sunbasket app and pick from 18 weekly recipes, and they are all mouthwatering. I always have a hard time choosing which ones I want. Sunbasket works with the best farms and suppliers to bring you fresh, organic produce and responsibly raised meats and seafood. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep, thank God. You can get a healthy and delicious meal on the table in about 30 minutes, even if you're me and you're terrible at cooking. So go to sunbasket.com/hellbent today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/hellbent for $35 off. sunbasket.com/hellbent. All right, Drexel, let's talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I actually didn't even watch it.
You didn't?
No,
it was so good.
I was watching Marvel movies.
That's fair.
So I could not watch it. I did read things about it. I actually, you know, I thought that some of the things that Michelle Wolf said were very funny. But at the end of the day, it's still a recognition ceremony. And I think that Washington put so much like emphasis on it, like it's their Oscars of the year,
right?
And you're like, you do this, you have the same criticism every year. You go through the same charade every year. Like, you think that the comedian goes too far. So if you don't want, like, what kind of comedian do you want?
Right.
Every year you say the same thing, and every year they get worse and worse because the president gets worse and worse.
Right.
So of course they're gonna come after you, and
we're going to respond to one thing in particular that happened. But first, I just want to say that the internet completely ignored my favorite joke of the whole opening set. So Michelle Wolf did this 20-minute set, this roast, which she was hired to do to open the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And my favorite joke that has nothing to do with anything, but I'm going to read it anyway. She said, quote, "A lot of people want Trump to be impeached. I do not, because just when you think Trump is awful, you remember Mike Pence. Mike Pence is what happens when Anderson Cooper isn't gay. Mike Pence is the kind of guy that brushes his teeth and then drinks orange juice and thinks, That's fucking funny.
That is funny. I just feel bad for Anderson Cooper because I like Anderson Cooper.
I do too, but I mean,
it was like a slight at Anderson Cooper. I'm right. Like, are you saying that he brushes his teeth and thinks that orange juice is delicious?
I mean,
Mike Pence isn't nearly as rich as Anderson Cooper.
That's true. That's very true. I think that's also part of this is that she wasn't just roasting Republicans. She did plenty. She went after Rachel Maddow, which was also hilarious.
It's true.
Calm the fuck down, okay? Because this is what she said about Democrats. Republicans are easy to make fun of, you know. It's like shooting fish in a Chris Christie. But I also want to make fun of Democrats. Democrats are harder to make fun of because you guys don't do anything. People think you might flip the House and Senate this November, but you guys always find a way to mess it up. You're somehow going to lose by 12 points to a guy named Jeff Pedophile Nazi Doctor. Oh, he's a doctor.
Oh, so true.
It's so true.
It's so true.
And it's hilarious. Jeff, pedophile Nazi doctor, will probably pull very well.
That is very true.
The joke that burned the internet to the ground, just set the internet on fire, was Michelle Wolf was talking about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, which at a correspondence dinner at an event that is about the press and their relationship with Washington, I feel like the press secretary is going to be a natural target. And she was also kind of there in place of Trump.
Which was a mistake.
Right. Because Trump skipped to go to Washington, Michigan and talk about Mexicans. So she said, every time Sarah steps up to the podium, I get excited because I'm not really sure what we're going to get. You know, a press briefing, a bunch of lies, or divided into softball teams. It's shirts and skins. And this time, don't be such a little bitch, Jim Acosta.
Like, that was funny.
That was funny. So the next part is why the internet is on fire. I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. She burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
Yeah, I didn't think that was as bad as people made it out to be.
It's not.
It's actually not bad at all.
I think, and then, so this big response to it was that she crossed a line by going after Sarah Huckabee Sanders' looks. Show me where she went after her looks.
I think that, I don't know if it was so much this quote or if it was the Handmaid's Tale.
She quote. Looks like Aunt Lydia from yeah. Handmaid's Tale. But the woman who plays Aunt Lydia, Anne Dowd, they don't really look that much.
I don't watch the Handmaid's Tale, but I assume that she's very homely looking.
She's not.
Is she? Oh,
she's not. She's yeah.
Okay. Looks, so then maybe, but I feel like that's where they might have.
Maybe. But even there, she wasn't comparing her to how she looks. Basically, Aunt Lydia's role is to propagate this propaganda around women subjugating themselves.
Yeah. Here's what I think, because Mika had some things to say. Maggie Haberman had some things to say.
Mitchell
had some things to say.
They can all shut the fuck up, as far as I'm concerned.
Everybody wanted to say something. And I feel like somebody got a phone call from the brass at the top that said, look, we already have a strained relationship with this White House. They basically want to kick us out, the press corps out of the White House as it is. We need to coddle them just a little bit.
But that's not the press's job.
I'm not saying that. Yeah, I definitely don't agree with that. I'm saying that in a time where their relationship with the White House is already strained, I think that they had to buckle down for a second. Because there's two things. I think they need to buckle down for a second. And I don't know what kind of conversations that Sarah Huckabee Sanders has with a lot of these women on the side, outside of once she steps off the group. If they feel like, and I don't know, I'm just this hypothetical. If they feel like she's getting unnecessary criticism because she's just doing her job and she's being a woman press secretary for a president like this is as hard as it is. Maybe they feel like they need to protect her in some way.
Yeah, okay. But my issue with that is Sarah Huckabee Sanders wakes up every morning and has a choice. She doesn't have to work for this dick. And as someone who I get alerts on my phone from Periscope every day when the press briefing is about to happen because I like to watch it, she stands up there and fucking lies her ass off every day. I mean, every press secretary, it's about spin. It's about, you know, getting the information you want out there. That's not what I'm talking about, though. She's not doing normal press secretary things where it's like burying bad stories under other stories. She's fucking lying to no, I the absolutely, face of the I, American people. So whether or not Andrea Mitchell has talked to her on the side and they've commiserated about being women in male-dominated fields, the joke wasn't about her looks and it wasn't about her just doing her job. It was about the fact that she wakes up every morning, flawlessly puts on her makeup, and lies to the public. The smoky eye is great. And she lies to the American people by choice.
And I totally get that. I think that the other part of that is we've had Dee Dee Myers. I think we've had three or four female press secretaries. So yeah, Dee Dee Myers, yeah, Dana Perino, who was Bush's press secretary. And then Barack Obama had three male press secretaries, right, basically, and a female deputy press secretary. She's basically the third or fourth female press secretary that we've had in two decades.
Yeah, but women supporting women for the sake of supporting women.
What I'm saying is, from a media standpoint, for them, I think that these women, Mika and Maggie and Andrea, probably said to themselves, if we don't pretend to protect her, the White House is going to be like, you guys don't protect women.
Oh, I know. But take that criticism then, because Sarah Huckabee Sanders might be a female press secretary and that's great. But that's sort of like saying I was going to vote for McCain because he chose a female running mate.
Right. No, I'm just
which saying, I'm not going to fucking do.
I'm playing devil's advocate as to why they would come out with these crazy statements, because there's no logical explanation for them to have done that other than somebody told them to. They felt compelled to protect her. Or, like, there's no other reason.
No, but I think there is, because these women in particular, these journalists in particular, rely on access journalism, which there's been a lot of debate about the role of access journalism, especially in the age of Trump. But the fact of the matter is that they only do their jobs effectively if they stay on the White House's good side.
Which I'm surprised about, because Maggie Haberman apparently has never met the president. So,
I mean, so the fact of the matter is that Maggie Haberman, in saying this, in defending Sarah Huckabee Sanders, there is this sort of underlying idea that she's basically mollifying this person that she needs access to, which I get. But when you talk about journalism and free speech and the way that the media covered the 2016 election, all of these postmortems, all of these goddamn books being written by journalists who covered Hillary Clinton, it's so rich for them to then sit there and turn around and say, you're being mean to Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Fuck that. You know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders deserves to take some shit, because she literally, her job is to lie to journalists. And it's so blatant. It's not like, oh, she's bending the truth or she doesn't mean to lie. She straight up lies with the straight face and a perfect smoky eye. Michelle Wolf really cuts to the heart of that in one of her last lines, one of her last jokes, which was, quote, you guys are obsessed with Trump. Did you used to date him? Because you pretend like you hate him, but I think you love him. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric.
Or Eric, that's funny.
But he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him. If you're going to profit off of Trump, you should at least give him some money, because he doesn't have any.
That's funny. And that probably, again, it's like nobody wants to hear what it goes back to what we said earlier at the top of the episode.
Right.
Nobody wants to hear what
they already know.
They already know.
So it's just difficult, because I think if we're being honest, that line is what pissed people off, and that's what they want to respond to. But it's a softer, easier way to say, oh, you're going after Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and she's a mother and she's a woman doing her job, and you went after her looks, which going after someone's makeup is not going after their looks. I'm sorry. It's just not. Like, I can say that shade of lipstick looks terrible on you. I'm not saying you're an ugly person. I'm saying check another shade of lipstick. Right?
Right.
I mean, like, there's a difference.
I mean, Anthony Scaramucci said the same thing about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and putting on more makeup. So, yeah.
I mean, so please spare me. Like, leave me out of this bullshit narrative, because that is the line that makes them angry. And there's truth to it. I mean, we've said it before on this podcast. We wouldn't have this podcast if Trump wasn't elected. There would be entire industries that would cease to exist if Trump wasn't elected.
It's almost like, would we have the women's marches,
right,
if Trump wasn't elected?
No.
Or any of the marches.
Right. Would a bunch of white women have, you know, gotten their shit together and rallied around people and people of color and started making affecting real change? Probably not.
Probably not.
And you know, that's hard to hear. And because we'd like to think that maybe like we're good people and we would actually do that. But like there's no fucking way. And so the fact that Michelle Wolf said it, she didn't even hide it. She didn't even like put it in a joke in a joke. She just said it. And I think that's why they're mad.
Oh yeah, they're definitely upset, because I think that once liberals aren't on the side of the media, they're fucked.
You're fucked. You're out of fucking moves, man.
Right. They're like, oh shit, you did create this motherfucker.
God damn it.
Damn you, media. Yeah,
exactly.
Damn you, Rachel Maddow. Not necessarily Rachel Maddow. I do give Rachel Maddow credit for having her big board of names, about 100, you know, and doing her due diligence. And Chris Hayes, for the most part. Chris Matthews, maybe not so much. he just yells at the camera.
Let's have some intellectual honesty, to use a term that the right loves, and say what we're actually angry about. Like, you're mad because she said it.
You know what I'm angry about?
What?
That Flint still doesn't have clean water.
Yes, that was her last line, and I think it's important that she used the last 5 seconds to say Flint still doesn't have clean water, which is absolutely correct.
All right, Devin, let's get into some gratitude check.
Yes. So for me, I actually added this morning. I had a different one. But I saw an article that I believe the Hellbent account posted that Seattle is vacating possession of marijuana-related conviction in light of the legalization of recreational marijuana use, which is fantastic because this has been such an issue with the debate about legalization. While it's really great and fun to legalize marijuana, I mean, I think so, you know, California, everyone thinks so. But the fact of the matter is that for years and years and years, marijuana and marijuana-related crimes have been used to put people of color in jail for minor offenses. From Forbes, the city of Seattle has filed a motion in municipal court to vacate, that is, retroactively void, all misdemeanor marijuana convictions in the city. According to a statement from Mayor Jenny Durkan, the request would affect 542 people. The city has also requested the dismissal of outstanding misdemeanor possession charges. In 2012, Washington became the first U.S. state to legalize marijuana for recreational use. It's frustrating because when we talk about like the war on drugs and this idea of prosecuting drug dealers, but really what ended up happening is they went after drug users, addicts, and people with small possession charges. And so Durkan, the mayor, echoed a growing consensus in describing Seattle's move as a, quote, important step to right the wrongs of the failed war on drugs. She particularly focused on drug laws' impacts on people of color who have for decades been convicted under aggressive drug laws at disproportionately high rates relative to whites. Which, yeah, duh. I mean, like, let's think about it. If I were 20 and caught with some marijuana on me, you know what would happen? Absolutely fucking nothing. I would get a reprimand from the cop and sent on my way.
Yeah, you know, here in California, it's super legal. Like, when I say super legal, it's like
in the streets.
Walk down the street and smoke a bowl. But, you know, I think you can start to see what I started to notice last week was Chuck Schumer, Kamala, like, they all had a message. And right now, the message is legalizing marijuana, which is very interesting. I think. I think that Mitch McConnell opened a door when he wanted to legalize hemp.
Right.
And
that's
so
right. I forgot about that.
So it gave everybody, like, you know, and so then Chuck Schumer was like, let's start legalizing marijuana then. And then if you watch them on Twitter, it was a snowball effect that Democrats started talking about legalizing marijuana and tweeting about it and talking about it. So I think a lot of these. A lot of these laws are going to change. And again, that
I think it has to come with this sort of retroactively voiding these convictions, though, because if we all of a sudden decide as a society that it's legal and it's fine, then these convictions makes no sense.
Right. And I think that that's something, if you're here in Los Angeles, that Eric Garcetti's going to have to work on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if he wants to run for president.
Right, which you know he does.
Which he probably won't do until next year so that he can get that momentum. And any of the other big cities as well, Mayor de Blasio is going to have to do the same thing, but it's not legal in New York State yet. So
it's going to be interesting to watch. And so I just hope that other cities take this tack and realize that the war on drugs was a racist policy used to incarcerate people of color at higher rates than white people. And they used marijuana to do it. Because like I said, when I was 20, if I got caught with marijuana, like they were like, oh no, like don't do that, little girl, and moved on. So Drexel, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for Joyanne Reed again.
Oh, Joyanne Reed.
Here's the thing.
Can you tell us why? Like what happened?
So a few years ago, Joyanne Reed had a blog. And apparently she allegedly made some homophobic comments on her blog. She's also made comments, you know, slight comments on Twitter about certain people. And so people kind of, the blog posts that allegedly happened, she said that she didn't write them. She maintained that, and then she went on to hire a cybersecurity firm to kind of look into those blog posts. They never turned up anything, and then coupled that with comments that she made about other people in like on Twitter and stuff like that. People correlated those comments to what maybe she might have thought in the past. Now, it is no secret that LGBT issues in the African American community are always strained. So things that Joy Reid may have said in the past would not surprise me. I don't know her. I don't know where she came from. It would not surprise me because then I think she had a comment to a friend of hers that where she said something like, you know, think of all the women that you could have dated, you know, just comments like that. That's stuff that anybody would, you know, I haven't heard that personally, but like that's stuff that I'm sure tons of people have heard across the country. And then there were calls for her to resign, not from the right, because they don't give a shit. you know, the Sanders votes from people who, you know, really wanted to go after her and who she has pushed back significantly on over the past couple of years during the election. And then she gave her opening statement on AM Joy on Saturday that was really well thought out. I think that she handled it really well. She answered for a few things. She still has to answer for the cybersecurity piece of it. Because like, why don't, if you wrote it, if you wrote it, say you wrote it, you know, as my mom used to say, if you're scared, say you're scared. The people get it. And
people will respect people you.
If you just say it. So this is kind of two-parter. Like, I am thankful that she made this statement and it has calmed the waters a little bit. I think that she can and should go a little bit further and clarify a few things and just say, but I don't think she can go back now, but I think that she should have taken that opportunity to do that.
Right. I mean, because she did say, my views on this have evolved. We're in a different place now, which...
Same thing with Barack Obama. Right. Same thing with Hillary Clinton. Same thing with a lot of our...
Which is fine. Like, I don't think that there's like the static idea that once you have an opinion, it will never change.
Especially as culture changes.
I mean, I agree. I think if she wrote it, you know, which I'm guessing she probably did.
She probably did.
Then just fucking say it. Come on, Joy. I was like, it's awful. Like, I wrote it and I can't believe I wrote it. And this is where we are.
And I've had conversations with my friends.
Yeah.
And we've talked through it and I've apologized to them. People get that kind of stuff.
Right. But the fact that she addressed it at all, I think was
great.
Was great.
All right, Devin, let's get into block five, our dickwad of the week.
Week.
I think this week is like a two-parter.
It's a two-parter.
This is a heavy black folk end of the episode. Because some black folks just aren't doing right, Devin.
Oh.
You know who ain't doing right?
Who?
Well, first of all, let's just address Bill Cosby for like a half a second.
Yes.
Because Bill Cosby didn't do right. Grateful. I'm glad this case is over. I won't say, Devin and I were talking about this right before we started recording because I can't say that I'm thankful that the verdict came out the way that it did. I mean, I guess I am on a certain level, but at the same time, it's also very sad, and it's also unfortunate that he put himself in that situation that not only affects him, affected the women that he assaulted, but also affects him, his family, and his colleagues on The Cosby Show, because all of those people who rely on residuals, they're pulling The Cosby Show from certain networks, and where they would get those residuals from several networks and syndication. And that's unfortunate. I think that at the same time, you, in the black community, to lose a voice like that is sad. And so, you know, if you're not hearing a bunch of black people rejoicing over the fact that Bill Cosby was convicted, it's because it's hard enough to be a black person out there as it is. This is and this is 100% as to why you never see black actors on the cover of OK magazine.
Interesting.
Because black African-American actors, people of color, typically don't want people in their business. If you know me, I'm a very private person. I do not like people in my business. And you don't see Denzel on the cut. Like, you just don't see those problems. So when it does happen, then, you know, there's a serious, serious issue. And, you know, it's almost like, and we're about to talk about Kanye West, but like, Kanye really wasn't in the public all that much until he started, until he married a Kardashian.
Right.
And so, you know, like that's the kind of stuff that is unfortunate for the black community, is to see one fall from grace almost, because that's not something that you want to have to talk about and want to have to talk to your kids about. Because, you know, I was listening to something the other day that said, I was listening to NPR where they were talking about the Cosby verdict, and you're like, you want to be able to separate Bill Cosby from Mr. Huxtable, because the lessons that you can learn from the show are still relevant to today. So you don't want to lose those messages and not be able to sit down with your family and watch a black family, an affluent black family at that, you know, kind of navigate these waters and do it together. And because there's not that many shows like that on television, or there weren't, and there certainly aren't making them now. So you always got to go back and watch the right old stuff.
It sounds like it's related, though somehow different, to this idea of separating art from artist when you talk about the Me Too movement in general. But you make a good point. There's not a lot of representation in this area. So do you think that it's worth, in this case, separating art from artist?
Not necessarily. As long as the art doesn't offend, then it's on, you know, it's like, you know, First Amendment. You can protect the First Amendment, but the First Amendment doesn't protect you from consequences. But on the other side, when you got people like Kanye West, who here's the thing about Kanye West. I think Kanye West is an idiot. He is. Or as Barack Obama calls him, and what did he call him? A jackass. He's a brilliant rapper, artist.
He is.
He is like Donald Trump in the sense that if he is not getting the attention that he feels he deserves, he will lash out. And you saw that this weekend or last week with him with his MAGA hat and right, getting it signed. Fine. But it's never happened before. Kanye West has never talked about his politics before. The only reason that he's talking about this shit now is because he has an album coming out. And it's almost like Kid Rock. Remember when Kid Rock was going to run for Senate?
Yeah.
People like flocked to him and it helped him out. And then he was like, no, I'm not running for goddamn Senate. Crazy. And Kanye West, I think his new album is going to be called 2024. At least that's what it looks like. Which, of course, he's going to have his first. He dropped a song this weekend that was partially political. So, of course, if anybody is a master at creating
hype,
it is the Kardashian family.
It's true.
And Kanye West fell into that trap, and he's a part of that family, and that's what he's doing right now. So he did that, and then he like roped in like Chance the Rapper and a couple other people, and I was like, everybody calm down. To where Chance actually had to come out,
right,
and respond to respond and clarify.
Well, because what Chance the Rapper said was black people don't have to be Democrats,
correct? Which is a true statement. To right. which I said, nobody ever said black people had to be Democrat. Black people just vote Democrats because Republicans don't care about black people.
Right.
Which Kanye West said.
In 2004. Yeah.
So like, he said George Bush, but in reality, he meant Republicans. And so, but I also think that people like Chance the Rapper and Kanye West bring up a good point when they're talking about their hometowns, when they're talking about places like Chicago and Detroit and inner cities where, yes, Democratic policies haven't necessarily
served
the people. Not that Republican policies would. Democratic right. policies just need to do a little bit better. They need to build better housing. They need to put that money back into better education. They need to build better gun policies on the streets. They right. need to, like, those are the policies that need to actually happen. Like, what we see on the national level has to happen on that local level. And I think that a lot of the artists can help their cities by putting the pressure, by standing next to the mayors and saying, here's what I want to put money into this.
Right, using their celebrity.
Using their celebrity to do that. And, you know, Republicans, they're so hypocritical because, like, on one hand, they don't want celebrities in policy. And then on the other hand, they have no problem with Kanye West, you know, coming out and saying, you know, everything that he's saying, but right. you know, and then like John Legend got into it and it became a thing, but like him and John are friends. And so Chrissy Teigen had a really funny tweet where she said, she tweeted at Kim Kardashian by saying, hey, are we still on for Friday night? because it was a baby shower that they were going
right,
to.
Right.
And so they, I don't know how I know all that, but
hey,
I do.
The
I
weird follow, things are brain
right, right,
just collects.
Right. And so like, that's what she's, you know, I think that, at the end of the day, what we have to remember is that Kanye is doing it for Kanye and or Kellyanne Kanye, as we like to call him, because he's got some alternative facts. But and he's just been, ever since his mom passed away a couple of years ago, like, he's just been a completely different person. So I think that this is going to be an album that is going to be, like, again, fairly political and something that he clearly wants people to pay attention to.
Yeah. I just wonder, because Trump tweeted about this.
Of course he did, because
he
Kanye
can't
West is the only black person that's ever said anything nice about him.
Right. And so my question is he using this? I think he's using this endorsement, what he sees as endorsements, which he actually like took Chance the Rapper's Black People Don't Have to Be Democrats as an endorsement, to create a narrative for his white voters that he has credibility in communities of color.
Right, where they say, oh, listen, black people do that. Like, other than Diamond and Silk, who...
Oh, God, who were, like, the stars of the Facebook testimony.
Right, that was bizarre. Yeah, like they can say, oh, yeah, it's not just Ben Carson, it's not just Diamond and Silk, it's not just, you know, what's her name here in California?
These names.
And it's also, like, high-profile celebrities. Like, he can get some of these celebrities as well. And to where Chance was like, I don't agree. That's what I said. Chance had to come back and clarify that, being like, I don't agree with anything that Donald Trump
right.
says. I just know that black people just don't have to be Democrats.
Right.
Like, which is, again, a true statement and something that the Democratic Party is going to have to wake up to.
Absolutely. And I thought that Vox had a really good... they unpacked his tweet a little bit, and there was a really good quote. He said, quote, the tweet also shows that Trump, who has attacked black public figures and politicians critical of him, and who has argued that the NFL protests against racial injustice are unpatriotic, still has no idea how to talk about race and the issues plaguing black communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. But I also think that I think Barack Obama's going to eventually have to wade into this. Somebody's got to ask him the question, because as the first black president, he's still that shining beacon on the hill, you know, the hill for black folks. And,
right.
and somebody's going to have to calm the waters. And the really only person that could do that is Barack Obama or Michelle Obama, really, not Kanye West.
All right, Drexel, last but not least, let's get into some action items that our listeners can do after they listen to the show. I have one action item for all of you today, and it relates back to Michelle Wolf's last point. Flint still doesn't have clean water. We are going on years. We're going on what is a public health emergency, and Michigan just recently voted to stop sending bottled water to citizens of Flint because apparently everything is better now. So fuck that. Donate time, water, or money to the effort to relieve the Flint water crisis. If you're in the Flint area, there are a couple of locations that you can drop water and cash off at. You can also volunteer with the Red Cross. You can just show up at the Flint Red Cross anytime between 7 a.m. and 9 p.m. And they say on their website, be prepared to work in cold conditions because Michigan, as my home state, is fucking freezing. And if you're not in the Flint area, actually, interesting fact, I actually have family in Flint who are being affected by this crisis. So this is an issue that is close to home for me personally. And if you're not in the Flint area, you can donate money by going to UnitedWayGenesee.org. Genesee is the county that Flint is in. And you can click the big red button at the top to donate to the Flint Water Fund. It is a verified way to give money. And you can also donate to the Flint Child Health and Development Fund at flintkids.org. And then flintcares.com is another resource that can direct you to meaningful ways to help. This is something that, again, government should be solving, and they are not. So now we're now people are fucking involved. If you do one thing this week, look into how you can help with the Flint water crisis, because they still don't have clean water.
Yeah, I would. I also would like to see like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Tom Steyer and some of our more progressive
philanthropists.
Philanthropist George Clooney, like, just really get in on this at this point, because there is something to be said. I think we talked about this episodes ago. There is something to be said about private companies helping out and being able to use their influence and money to for a good cause. So. And even if it's building new housing and moving those people out of Flint until they can kind of help and redo those pipelines, because it's an infrastructure problem at this point.
And just remember, this was an elected official who made a choice to change the way the pipes work and poisoned an entire town. Don't forget that. All right, Hellions, that is it for us. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I feel like we had some really lively discussion.
There was.
It was really great.
You know, I always love talking about the Democratic Party.
I know.
It's my favorite.
It is your favorite. So, all right, Hellions, I will see you back here on Thursday. Have a great week and raise some hell.
Bye.